This case will be taken under advisement. Mr. Willis, you took this case by court appointment, I understand. And you have the deep thanks of the court for rendering very fine assistance on behalf of your client. Our next case is number 05-1785, the United States against Paul Van El. Mr. Bindi.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Your Honors, the district court granted the defendant's motion for a new trial because it found that the prosecutor's rebuttal argument, an objection to which had been overruled at trial, violated the court's pretrial ruling on a motion in limine. This was error. The in limine ruling concerned what the witnesses that the government called would be permitted to say in their testimony regarding their perception of the conduct, which was the underlying basis of the fraud in this case.
Mr. Bindi, let me stop you. First of all, it is so odd to see you sitting over there that I can't get used to it. Secondly, in the brief, you argued that the closing argument tracked the witness's testimony.
Yes, ma'am.
And where in the record will we find any of these witnesses testifying about right and wrong, fraud, truth, and falsity? Those are the very things, it seems to me, that the district court ruled that the witnesses couldn't say. So how could that argument possibly track the testimony?
Our position, Your Honor, is that the argument is supported by the testimony. And I don't think really that the district court would argue with that, because the district court did not find that the prosecutor's argument was unsupported by the testimony or went beyond the bounds of the testimony. You have to remember the issue in this case is knowledge and intent. 99% of the time, that element of a crime, particularly a fraud crime like this, is proved by circumstantial evidence. It is a given that the evidence presented at trial will serve only as a platform for both parties, really, to argue that the jury must take the next logical steps in the direction that the evidence points. And I think that the prosecutor fairly did that here. You know, the district court did not find, really, that the argument was unsupported by the evidence. In the course of making the in limine ruling in the first place, the district court found that the implication from the testimony, the necessary implication, the thing that naturally followed from the testimony, was that the witnesses believed that these manipulations of account status in the loan portfolio were going to lead to false and fraudulent financial reporting by the company. Now, the district court did allow the government to argue, based on the testimony of Peter Gorman, that if Gorman could see fraud here, so could the defendant. It allowed that because Gorman confronted the defendant with his concerns at the time. It's our position that while other witnesses did not make that confrontation, and therefore the inference that the prosecutor drew is a little bit less compelling than it is with Peter Gorman, it's nevertheless not improper, and it's not unsupported by the testimony. We also contend, Your Honors, that the argument was invited because the defendant essentially made the same argument. He said that the fact of all these massive deferrals of accounts was disclosed to outside auditors, to outside counsel, to the banks, and that the auditors and the lawyers were the ones who effectively prepared the 10-K statement that was filed with the SEC the following year. So the defendant actually made the same argument, and it was fair for the government to make an argument in response that those people were not similarly situated, that insiders within FMAC were similarly situated people. They could see what the outside auditors could not. They could see what the defendant could see, which is that these deferments were not being granted on an individualized basis, in accordance with the proper office of a deferral. Rather, they were being selected in large blocks of severely delinquent accounts for the purpose of lowering a nearly 10% loss rate to a target rate between 6 and 8%. Now, the defendant argues that that the prosecutor's argument had the effect of basically telling the jury that the witnesses had given legal opinions concerning their perception of what was going on and that this was a violation of Rule 701. He also argues that the prosecutor's argument was deviating from the actual testimony. But the district court rejected both of these arguments. So the defendant's line of argument in this court is an abandonment, first of all, of his original objection to the testimony or to the argument, and second, an abandonment of the basis for the district court's ruling granting him relief.
It seems to me it's quite a high mountain for you, you know, to scale here, Mr. Bindi, because the standard of review is very deferential to the district court, and it certainly seems that Judge Zagel looked at this very closely before he decided that a new trial was warranted.
Well, Your Honor, we have made an argument that this court should not affirm unless it finds that the prosecutor's argument constituted plain error. We stick by that position because, again, the defendant's position from, you know, his original objection at trial to his argument here in this court is different. And his argument here in this court, again, represents an abandonment of the district court's basis for granting the motion in the first place. So we think that our forfeiture argument is valid. But even by an abuse of discretion standard, Your Honor, we feel very strongly that that the district court did not set a limit in the ruling in limine on what inferences could be argued from the testimony that came in without objection anyway to the substance of it. It's also, Your Honor, the government's position that there has been no case cited to this court, and there was no cases cited below either, to the effect that this general line of argument is categorically improper. There is no law that I'm aware of, either case or rule or statute or whatever, that says that it's categorically improper for the prosecutor to say, well, if similarly situated people could see a problem with the conduct, then the defendant could see it too.
Bindi, wouldn't it be permissible for a district judge in a particular case to determine that, given all of the evidence before the court, there is a danger in this case that the jury will misconstrue the witness's testimony and will consider this to be a rendition of legal opinion on their part, that what was going on within the company was illegal. And therefore, the judge creates a buffer zone, if you want, and says, look, I'm not even going to let you get close to that one. And I want you to stay far enough away that we avoid juror confusion. Now, if that's the prerogative of the trial judge, and he later finds that, in fact, that that order was violated, why can't he say, we're going to do it over again?
Your Honor, it is definitely within a district court's prerogative to set those kind of parameters in an individual case. But the only parameters that were set by the district court in this case, again, concerned what the witnesses could say. There is nothing in that in limine ruling that clearly suggests or clearly spells out that that the argument that the prosecutor made, if these people could see something wrong, if these people could see that this conduct was going to affect the financial reporting, then Paul Van Isle could see it too. The district court did not make that at all clear in its in limine ruling, and in fact, we believe, suggested that the argument the prosecutor ended up making would be approved, because he said in effect that the implication is very clear from the testimony itself. We've also made a harmless error argument because we think that the jury would have necessarily drawn that implication whether it was argued to them or not. So for these reasons, Your Honors, we respectfully request that the judgment be reversed and the conviction reinstated.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Campbell.
Morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court, Terry Campbell on behalf of Paul Van Isle. I want to start by addressing something that Mr. Bindi spent some time on, and that is this issue or this claim by the government that the defendant somehow abandoned the argument that he made below. That is simply not borne out by the facts. We filed a motion in limine seeking to preclude any witness from offering legal opinions that the conduct was wrong or fraudulent. The judge discussed that motion and made a ruling very clearly on the record, and it's cited in the briefs. The ruling of the court was you can elicit testimony using certain words, and you have to avoid words like fraud or wrong. You can use things like this was irregular or I thought it violated company policy. But the key point of the ruling was the judge said, Judge Zagel said, you can only elicit that testimony for the purpose of showing why the witness did what he did next. You cannot elicit that testimony for the purpose of arguing or showing that Paul Van Isle had the intent to defraud. And that was the issue in this case, whether the government could prove that Paul Van Isle had the intent to defraud. The conduct that took place was admitted after the motion in limine and the ruling on that. The defense consistently, every time the issue came up at trial, objected to any witness being able to offer testimony about their thoughts, their beliefs, that the conduct was fraudulent or improper or morally wrong, and those objections were upheld. Then we get to closing argument, and the ground rules were perfectly clear. As we said in our brief, it was at least twice stated on the record by the prosecutor to the court. We understand what the ruling is. We've told our witnesses, you can't say those words. You cannot give your opinion that this was morally wrong or fraudulent, and we've instructed our witnesses not to do that in adherence with your ruling in limine. We get to the rebuttal argument. The rebuttal argument of the government, when the defendant has no chance to respond, and the first thing that's said is, Steve Zimaitis could tell right from wrong. Immediately, the defense objected to that, based on the ruling in limine, based on the consistent rulings during trial, that the judge had precluded exactly that testimony. And the government says we somehow abandoned the argument? Where in the world is that in the record? The second piece, which simply does not make sense in the government's argument, is, well, it was implicit in the testimony, and therefore we're allowed to argue it. Even though the judge said, you cannot offer that testimony for that specific purpose. You cannot square those two things. You cannot stand here and say, well, the judge said that testimony can only be offered for this particular purpose. And that's what Judge Zagel said. He said, you can offer that solely in circumstances where it's necessary to show why the witness did what he did next. You cannot then say, well, I'm allowed to argue it for whatever I want.
May I shift the focus
certainly
a bit?
Certainly.
Judge Zagel, in his order granting the new trial, says that the thrust of your case was that these witnesses had not communicated their misgivings to your client. Is that an correct characterization of your case?
It's certainly one portion of it. It's certainly one.
The thrust of your case?
I wouldn't say it was the thrust. It was one aspect of the case, Your Honor. The fact of the matter was that none of these people, putting aside Mr. Gorman, ever came to Paul Van Isle and said, hey, we think this is wrong. One of the more important parts, and this is something that Mr. Bindi touched on when he was up here, is if you were able to say that people were similarly situated, that would be one thing. But the evidence clearly established that Van Isle was not similarly situated with the people that the judge focused on. He was not similarly situated with Zimaitis or Zielinski or Hake or Smagley. None of them had been involved in the conversations that Mr. Van Isle had been involved in, where Mr. Kahn, the CEO with long experience, says, I've gotten this approved by the board. I've gotten this okayed by the banks.
Help me out with this,
yes, sir,
if you would. if the district court in this order makes that statement that the thrust of your case had not been communicated, if we disagree that really is the thrust of your case, should we allow his ruling to stand? Doesn't it seem to be really based on a misapprehension of where you were going with this case?
No, Judge, because I think it absolutely was one portion of the argument, but there's so much more to support the position that the defense has made. And I think it's obviously very important to recognize what the standard of review here is, and that is for an abuse of discretion. The government, in order to mount its case, has to say Judge Zagel was wrong about every factual finding he made. He was wrong about whether he had precluded this. Well, I think Judge Zagel's in the best position to know whether he had precluded it by his ruling in limine. They say he's wrong about whether or not this was prejudicial. Well, that's a factual finding by the district court that is entitled to great weight. They say he's wrong about having not allowed this into evidence in the first place. Well, again, that is reviewed for an abuse of discretion standard. The judge has the authority to do that. He exercised that discretion.
What standard should he have applied when determining whether the error was harmless? Because he seemed to have decided that a new trial was required because he couldn't conclude that the error did not affect the verdict. And it seems to me the correct standard would have been a substantial likelihood of affecting the verdict.
Well, I believe, at least in my view, the correct standard is, was there a reasonable probability that it affected the verdict? And I think it's clear, given all the briefs that were submitted to Judge Zagel, and given the totality of the language that's in his decisions, that's what he concluded, that there was a reasonable probability that this affected the verdict. He so much as says that when he says he cannot conclude that it didn't affect the verdict. So I don't think there's any doubt when you look at the pleadings that were in front of him and the cases cited to Judge Zagel by the parties on the papers, that he knew what the standard was.
So it's your view that what he was saying essentially was that, look, this is a very close case, and it won't take much of an error for me to doubt the validity of the verdict. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's exactly what Judge Zagel said, Your Honor, yes. And again,
I'm channeling Judge Zagel.
We get back to how this is viewed by this court, and that is, in order to reverse what Judge Zagel concluded about these facts, you'll have to find that he was so clearly erroneous that no district court could have found what he found. And I don't think that it's possible to come to that conclusion on the record.
I know we have that, you know, that kind of language in our cases, but that's more poetry than reality. Isn't it? I mean, no district court?
Well, Judge, you would certainly have to find it, at a minimum, very clearly erroneous. It is not, as this court has stated on any number of occasions, sometimes poetically, sometimes not, it's not this court's duty to reevaluate witnesses' credibility or
the
effect.
You have to decide if you wandered off the farm.
That's right, Your Honor. That's right, Your Honor. The last thing, or one of the last things I want to point out, is one of the things that I think gives lie to the government's argument is something that they admitted in their reply brief. I don't think there can be any question that when a prosecutor argues this witness knew this was fraud, that is a legal conclusion. I don't think there's any question about that. And the government, in its reply brief...
Wait.
Yes.
Why is it a legal conclusion?
Well, because fraud is a legal term.
Yeah, but that isn't what he said. He said there's no question that this is what he thought or knew.
What he said is, and pardon me if I have the names wrong, Zelensky could tell a fraud when he saw a fraud.
No.
And I think...
That's different from saying that he knew something. That's speculation, guess, and conjecture at best. What I know, you can't tell.
I'm sorry, in terms of what Zelensky or Hayden Smagley knew?
Anything.
That's right. And what the prosecutor's argument, I don't think there's any doubt about this, and it's clearly what Judge Zagel found, having heard the argument, was he was arguing to the jury, this individual told you, I knew this was a fraud. That's a legal conclusion. That's the one determination that the jury
it's
has
to make. It's a factual statement, not a legal conclusion. This witness told you that.
This was discussed.
A reasonable inference from the testimony is what we argue all the time. Whatever is in evidence and what's a reasonable inference from the evidence, right?
And this was discussed with Judge Zagel at
the... Well, so far I'm right.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. But that's
so what you're saying is, even if it were a reasonable inference, he wasn't allowed to argue because Zagel had told him that.
That's exactly right.
All right.
That's exactly right.
That's at least a reasonable position.
Thank you, Your Honor. And that's why the motion was based not just on the fact that you're not allowed to offer legal opinions, but 403. And the judge ruled on that. And again, that ruling is entitled to substantial deference. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir. You have 1 minute left, Mr. Bindi.
Mr. Campbell said that as closing argument approached, the ground rules were clear. Well, the objection was overruled, and the district court said that the prosecutor's alleged error was perfectly understandable and not the result of deliberate misconduct. So I don't think the ground rules were all that clear. If anything, I think the ground rules would have permitted the prosecutor to make the argument that he did. Mr. Campbell says that the defendant's position has consistently been that this evidence was admitted for a limited purpose. Well, he didn't ask that the jury be instructed to that effect, and the district court did not give the jury an instruction to that effect. He says that in the in limine ruling, Judge Zagel told the prosecutor that the evidence was coming in for a limited purpose to explain why the witnesses took the next actions that they took, and that you can't argue anything else off of it. Judge Zagel said no such thing in the in limine ruling. The harmless error standard applied by the district court, we've argued in our brief, was the wrong standard, and I'll leave that at that. The defendant also says that Van Isle was not similarly situated to the other people, the other insiders in the company, and that's just flat wrong. Thank you.
Thank you to Mr. Bindi and to Mr. Campbell as well. The case will be taken under advisement. We have completed the call of the day, and therefore the court will rise until 9:30 tomorrow.